This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. So, hear those footsteps? We're going to talk about something really basic now. Walking. And specifically, we're asking you what makes a city walkable. And how walkable or walker-friendly is Boston, or the city or town where you live? And Meghna, let me ask you. You live in Brookline. How walkable is your neighborhood?
Very. It's actually one of the reasons why I don't even own a car.
That's great. So what are the key ingredients that make your neighborhood in Brookline so walkable?
Okay, so within a 10-minute slow saunter of my neighborhood or where I live, there are 3 grocery stores, a great local bookstore, 2 elementary schools, a bunch of restaurants, 2 big parks, a university, a local cinema, a train line, several bus lines, a great bar, functioning and actually high-end bakery. Should I go on?
Okay, we get it. Now, by contrast, I'm going to tell you about my part of the city, East Somerville. So, don't get me wrong, I love it there. It's close to a lot of interesting parts of the city, including Union Square, which is very walkable. But there's a big problem, because separating our side of Somerville from all those restaurants, coffee shops, and markets of Union Square is the McGrath-O'Brien Highway.
Yeah.
Big, elevated, ugly gash of a thing that runs right through the heart of our neighborhood, cuts us off from the rest of the city. And to get across it, you have to walk under an ugly overpass, negotiate 2 crossings of 2 very wide and busy boulevards, a big, ugly traffic circles. There isn't even a functioning pedestrian crosswalk to get across that. So it's very much man against machine, pedestrians versus the automobile. And in our part of town, I got to say the automobile rules. So it discourages folks from walking.
Yeah, that sounds like definitely not a pedestrian's paradise. I mean, Brookline has its cars. I mean, they're further away from where I live. Route 9 does actually cut across Brookline. But pedestrians really do have a fighting chance, mostly because I think people would complain that there's no parking in Brookline. But from my perspective, it's a great place to be on foot all the time.
So how we handle cars is a big part of what makes a walkable city. The good news for those of us who live, work, and play in and around Boston is that this is one of those rare walkable American cities. That's according to Jeff Speck. He's a city planner based in Washington, D.C. He grew up in this area, by the way. His new book is called Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. And it's sort of a call to arms, or to feet, I guess, on behalf of developing vibrant cities. And Jeff Speck joins us now from Washington. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you, Jeff.
Thanks. Thanks for bringing me back to Boston.
Yeah,
I should say you guys are doing this pretty well without me. I'm not sure if I'm in this segment.
Well, it's been great having you, and come back again soon. No, seriously, the book is
a call to feet. I had not thought of a call to feet.
Do you like that? That just came to me moments before I came on the air. But I want to talk to you about what makes Boston one of those rare walkable cities. But first, lay out the challenge here and tell us why this is such an important issue. How does a walkable city help make a vibrant city?
Well, you know, I'm a city planner. I was trained as an architect, actually, in Boston. I grew up in Belmont, took the bus to architecture school for 4 years from my parents' house. I know Boston very well, and you're right. It is one of the I'd say, 2 handfuls of cities in America that the pedestrian rules where it's car optional. You can own a car, but in many cases, you can make the choice not to own it, and life is actually easier. I have a similar circumstance in Washington, or at least I did until my wife and I had our second child, in which case we needed the vehicle as a containment device as much of, as anything else.
Right.
But, when I moved to Washington from Miami, which is a car-centric city, I eventually got rid of my car, and not out of any ideological, determination, but just it was easier to not have it, right? And Boston's that kind of city, too. But these are rare cities in America,
mm-hmm.
and it's easy to get the argument wrong because the intellectual leadership in our country, so much tends to happen in these places. So most of the places I've been doing readings for the book where people want to hear me, like Portland and Seattle and Boston and Washington and New York, are places that need me the least.
They've sort of got it figured out, this walkability issue. Yeah.
It's both a function of how the cities grew historically, but then what happened in the last 50 or 60 years and whether the cities allowed themselves to be redesigned around the car, which has happened to so many cities. And then you have, of course, all of our Sunbelt cities, which grew up around the car, and those are the hardest to walk in, and frankly, the hardest to fix.
Well,
I didn't answer your question.
I was about to restate it, but go ahead, because that was all important, what you said by way of preamble.
So I was never focused on walkability. I was interested in making beautiful buildings and beautiful places. Mm. But by hook or by crook, I ended up working in a program. I was at the National Endowment for the Arts and worked with this program called the Mayor's Institute on City Design, where every 2 months, somewhere in America, we'd gather together 8 mayors and 8 designers. Menino came a number of years ago. We'd lock ourselves in a room. Each mayor would bring their toughest design challenge in their city, and we'd try to fix it. And problem after problem, mayor after mayor, it kept coming down to, I want my city to be more walkable. Mm. Or if my city has street life, then that is an indication that my city is successful. So it became the focus of my efforts. And then wonderfully, you know, because no one really listens to planners or frankly to architects, but wonderfully, not too long ago, a number of other groups who people do listen to, epidemiologists who look at, you know, how healthy Americans are, mm-hmm. economists who look at where Americans are most productive, and environmentalists who have turned on a dime from being kind of anti-city and pro-country now to recognizing that it is the densest cities in America that have where people have the lightest carbon footprint. These three groups are saying that for the health, wealth, and sustainability of our country, we need to attract more people to cities and give them an urban lifestyle where driving is not essential to their lives.
In your book, Walkable City, you say that we've understood this basic thing for decades. We know how to make livable cities, walkable cities, and we have some great examples of that, as you mentioned, including New York, Chicago, here in Boston. But you say despite knowing how to do this, most cities don't. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, Jane Jacobs won over the intellectual community, planners and lots of other people who work with planners, developers and government officials, probably by 1980. You know, she wrote in the early 60s, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, this book that completely insulted the current planning establishment and way of thought, which was, you know, tearing down places like Scully Square in mm-hmm. Boston and replacing them with, remember that, I forget what it's called, but it's those towers in the park, and you drive by it, it says, it used to say, if you lived here, you'd be home by now.
There on the Charles River. Yeah.
And I remember once I was driving to the airport with my folks, and someone had put a sheet over the second one and said, if you lived here, you'd be a yuppie blank hole instead, which was memorable. But the problem is that even though the intellectual war has been won, and most mayors and other city leaders will tell you that they want to have a more walkable city, that day by day, the daily design decisions that are creating our cities and impacting our cities are not being made by anyone in charge. They're being made typically by a public works director who is trying to satisfy the principal complaint that he or she is hearing. And that principal complaint is almost always about traffic or parking. Mm. And so they believe that by serving, that their way to serve their citizens is to try to solve the traffic problem.
So moving, getting traffic to move quickly through the city,
right.
to set up places to put your car, park your car, that's going to solve the problem, but that doesn't necessarily make it more walkable.
Well, the problem is it doesn't solve the problem.
Okay, right.
the one thing we've learned from, 30, 40, 50 years of trying to solve the traffic problem is that cars take what you give them and then ask for more. And that's a
they're
phenomenon.
They're a greedy breed.
They are. Well, they're, I say they're an instrument of freedom that's enslaved us, but they are, the technical term is induced demand. Mm-hmm. It's now been scientifically proved beyond any question that when you increase roadway capacity or parking capacity to satisfy either existing congestion or anticipated growth, that you cause that congestion and growth to increase. And that within a few years' time, you've used up, people have changed their behavior because we do not pay the true cost of driving in this country. There's always latent trips that are ready to attack your road as soon as you widen it.
Yeah.
So, the way that the planner Jan Gehl, the Danish planner, puts it is that cars behave like water, and it's a relationship between invitations and behavior. And those cities that have allowed the car more room, the car's taken more room. And the cities like Boston that typically haven't, they still have as you said, they give the pedestrian a fighting chance.
We're talking to Jeff Speck. He's author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. Listeners, what makes your neighborhood walkable? What would make it more walkable? Give us a call. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook, where a conversation about this has already begun at Radio Boston. Let me ask you, I'm really intrigued to talk to you a little bit about Europe and about Rome in particular, about which you write at the beginning of your book. And I'm interested in this for a couple of reasons. I actually spent a big chunk of my childhood growing up in an Italian city, so I sort of
lucky
understand.
You.
Yeah, I was lucky. But the point you make, you write this, which is so intriguing. Rome at first glance seems horribly inhospitable to pedestrians. Half the streets are missing sidewalks. Many lack crosswalks. Pavements are uneven and rutted. And yet, it's rated by Lonely Planet and others as one of the top 10 walking cities. So what makes Rome so walkable in spite of all those apparent defects is something that you call fabric.
And let's not forget the Roman drivers.
The Roman drivers.
But and by the way, Boston's in that top 10 list of the world.
Interesting.
As well.
Wow.
It's a Lonely Planet list.
So what is the fabric, though?
Yeah, fabric is, and this is the thing that's so often forgotten in the walkability discussion, particularly as cities are investing in trying to make themselves more walkable, is that, my general theory of walkability, which the book breaks into 10 steps, has the four categories of walk you have to satisfy. The walk has to be useful, the walk has to be safe, the walk has to be comfortable, and the walk has to be interesting. Useful is a function of proper mix of uses, you know, having things at arm's length. Safe is what most people turn to when they're trying to improve walkability. What sort of crosswalks and ramps and, size of sidewalks can I put in, et cetera. But comfortable and interesting is typically not the city's responsibility. The city codes, building codes and planning codes can influence it. But what is lining the street? And if you have a parking lot, you know, a surface parking lot or a structured parking lot or a Jiffy Lube or a used car lot lining the street, it doesn't matter what you do to the quality of the roadway and whether it's the broadest sidewalk and the slowest moving traffic, people aren't going to choose to make that walk. And I'm interested in creating pedestrians, particularly in cities where people have that choice. Because in most American cities, driving is cheap enough, parking is cheap enough, and people will continue to stay in their cars unless the walk offers them something competitive. And what it can offer them is a lovely experience.
But
and
what
so
do,
yeah, Rome offers that because it has, as does much of Boston, it has the buildings hugging the street, giving you a sense of being in an outdoor living room. It has doors and windows that give you something to look in or at. And that's why when cities invest in walkability, they need to focus their physical investments in those places that have fabric already first, because that's where people are ready to go.
Sure. Well, just sticking for a moment with Rome or other Italian cities and actually cities all across Europe, one of the things they do is simply close city centers off to traffic, as you know. You mentioned a section in Rome where that happens, but is that a solution for us to consider in this country?
It's a solution that many cities are considering. I know that Mayor Menino was considering doing it with, is it Hanover Street, the main street in the North End?
That is the main street in the North End.
When he came to the Mayor's Institute, I was one of many people who suggested that he not do that. The history in America is that over 150 main streets that were closed to vehicular traffic between 1960 and 1975 all failed almost immediately. About 30 still remain in the U.S. Almost all of those are either in college towns, like in Burlington, Vermont, or Boulder, or Madison, Wisconsin, or in resorts like South Beach or Santa Monica. And very few cities in America have stores that can survive without cars parking on the curb in front. New York certainly can. Pieces of Boston possibly can, but the biggest lesson there was, you know, don't think that the same thing done in different places will produce the same result. And also, if you're going to do it again, don't spend millions of dollars, which many of these cities did, millions of dollars, making it impossible to open up the street again without spending millions of dollars again. Just put a few cones down, see what happens, and then consider making it permanent if it works.
Well, let's get some callers into this conversation. Again, we're talking to Jeff Speck. He's author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. We're asking you how to make Boston or your town or neighborhood more walkable. 800-423-8255. Let's go to Robbie, who's calling from Dorchester. Hi, Robbie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to lend my sort of support to the comment that your guest made regarding how cars become relentless in when you give them some space. There's just more and more demand for the cars having authority, so to speak, over the city. In reference, Robert Moses did to New York City, I mean, he essentially chopped the boroughs in pieces, the Cross Bronx Expressway. His opinion was we should get the cars from here to there. And it ended up with people who lived across the street from a neighborhood variety store not even be able to access their own neighborhood store anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, Jeff Speck, I'd love you to comment on what Robbie just said.
She refers to a story that's well told in one of the best books ever written, which is The Power Broker by Robert Caro, which is the story. It's just such a thick book. People are afraid to open it. But it's a beautifully written book that describes one of the most powerful men in American history, who not everyone's heard of.
He was a city planner, Robert Moses, right?
For the New York metropolitan area. And the person who finally stopped him was actually Jane Jacobs.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience of building highways in cities is one of actually not only destroying cities physically with what they do in terms of splitting up neighborhoods, as Robbie suggested, but also economically. And there's a wonderful paper, I won't get into the details of it, but it's mentioned in my book, that clearly shows a direct inverse relationship between highway investment in cities and inner city property values. And it's almost like an hourglass for many cities looking at the path, you know, the history of investment in building highways and the history of inner city real property values, and that essentially every dollar you spend to make it easier to get in and out of your city makes the city more worthless.
Mm. Of course, we've just sort of gone through a long period of here in Boston of trying to recover from that highway through the middle of cities era by sticking that central artery underground. Awful lot of money spent building a highway right through the heart of Boston, and then several generations later spending a whole bunch more money to put it underground. And, you know, I'd like to believe, Jeff Speck, that we've gotten smarter about this idea of not encouraging the dominance of the car culture at the expense of vibrant cities. But you say, in fact, we're still promoting roads, cars, cement, rubber, and gas with big subsidies at the expense of vibrant cities and public transportation.
Yeah, I mean the there's so many ways, hidden ways that we subsidize driving at the expense of walking, at the expense of public transportation. You know, I think the number is $700 million in New Jersey alone that is paid to support the state roads, and of that $700 million a year, fully half of it is coming not from gas taxes but from general tax revenues. So that means that people who don't drive, who can't drive, you know, the elderly, et cetera, are paying for the streets that they're not driving on. So any time you have, the non-drivers subsidizing the drivers, you know that the system is a little bit off. Now every sort of transportation, except perhaps walking and biking, requires some sort of investment. But for so many years, you know, people have used the terms roadway investment and transit subsidy, when it really could be looked at just as easily the other way around. And what we're seeing in America for many years, at least at the federal level, the investment in non-transit, you know, the investment in roadways has been 5-1, the investment in transit, or considerably higher.
Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Peabody. Hi, Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually for the cars. I have to speak of this, that I actually live in the suburbs, but primarily work as a consultant in the city. And I enjoy the freedom of being able to leave the city at any point in time. And if I want to leave at 2:00 in the afternoon and go to the beach, I can. If I want to meet a client at quarter past in the morning, somewhere out in the other part of the state, I can. And I drive in pretty much every day, 5 to 6 days a week. And I'm in a higher tax bracket, I'll admit. And I think the result, I'm spending more money into the city, which I normally would not, if I didn't have automobile access.
Tony, I'm glad you brought this perspective to the conversation. Jeff Speck, is Tony's desire to have the freedom of the car to move in and out of a city at odds with advocating for a vibrant, walkable city?
Let me think. Yes. But I have to say, I've been on, this is about the sixth hour of radio I've been on since I wrote this book. And I'm so happy to finally have someone call in and just say I'm for the Cars, because this is the first caller in 6 hours of radio.
Well, what would you say to Tony?
Well, what I'd say to Tony is that he has every right to continue his lifestyle. And I have something horrible to admit. I am feeling extraordinarily out of sorts today because I just bought an SUV.
Oh, boy.
Because my wife is in a car. The only way that she can have a good life in Washington, now that we're in a charter school, which is a public school, but it's a charter school at some distance from our house, and we need to carpool, and the only way we could carpool was with that third row of seats. So the author of this book on walkability just bought a used, smallish, but not that small, SUV. So I understand that there's a need for that, that there are people who need to drive cars, and then there are people who have the choice to drive cars, and particularly those in a higher tax bracket have that choice. And all I would argue is that they are willing to pay their fair share of what it means to society in terms of using those cars. And I think if we asked our drivers to pay the true costs of driving, we'd have a lot fewer of them, because the true costs of driving have been estimated at about, you know, four times what drivers are actually paying. Hmm. It's at least twice as much if you consider direct costs like roadway construction and repair. And if you include indirect costs like ambulances and hospitalization and pollution and global warming, that's a little expensive. It could be about four times as much. So, for example, New York City, New York City failed to put a congestion pricing scheme in place, but London succeeded. And the mayor of London was reelected in a landslide when all the people who fought the idea of charging $15 to enter London saw how great it was for London to have a fewer cars on the road.
You know, as we mentioned, you grew up here. You grew up in Belmont. You went to college here. So you know this. You must have a pretty good idea of this city. I'm heartened that this city makes your very short list of truly walkable American cities. But what? How could we improve? How could we make it more walkable? When you come back to Boston, what do you see? What would you like to see improved?
Well, the great thing is I'm having an opportunity to participate in that. And my clients in Somerville would be very disappointed if I didn't share with you and invite you all, frankly.
Near and dear to my heart.
Yes. So I'm working with the Somerville City Planning Department on the answer, how could Boston be more walkable, is to keep investing in transit. And as you know, the Green Line is extending deeper into Somerville.
That's right.
And three of the new stops that are proposed to be open by 2018-2019, one's in Ball Square, one's in Gilman Square, and one's in Magoon Square. And I'm helping them create neighborhood plans surrounding each of those stops. And the understanding is, you know, when the most successful trolley in America, the Green Line, which every city salivates looking at the 7,000 daily boardings per passenger boardings per mile that the Green Line has, when that's extended into a community and a nice station is put there, and very nice stations are planned in these Somerville locations, neighborhoods change. It's very important when those changes happen to have a vision of what you want. So we've been working in the community, and before I finish the statement, let me just say,
yeah,
January 8th at 6:30 p.m. in the Somerville Armory, or as they say, the Armory.
The Armory. Okay.
I'll be presenting these plans.
Well, we'll be there. That Green Line extension into Somerville has been something that people have been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for. They finally broke ground on that project. You probably know this just this week, so it's very exciting. Yep. Good to know you're involved. Jeff Speck, thanks so much for joining us today. What a pleasure.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Jeff Speck is a city planner and the former director of design at the National Endowment for the Arts. His new book is Walkable City: How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. Stay with us. Coming up, our weekend picks embrace the Christmas season. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.